All right, everyone, welcome to Using Data and Information Systems in Partnered Research, a cyber seminar series hosted by VIREC, the VA Information Resource Center. Thank you to CIDR for providing technical and promotional support. This series focuses on VA data use in both quality improvement and operations research partnerships. This includes query projects and partnered evaluation initiatives. This slide shows the series schedule. Sessions are typically held on the third Tuesday of every month at 12 p.m. Eastern. You can find more information about this series and other VIREC cyber seminars on VIREC's website, and you can catch up on previous sessions on HSR&D's VIREC cyber seminar archive. Today's presentation focuses on opioid prescribing practices in VA. Our presenters will discuss the landscape of opioid safety efforts in VA, how to measure opioid exposure, and they will also to discuss the challenges and lessons learned in studying non-VA opioid exposure. The session is titled Dual Use of Controlled Substances in and Outside of VA, Clinical Context and Measurement Challenges. Doctors William Becker and Brenda Fenton are here to present the session. Dr. Becker is a general internist with a training in clinical epidemiology, addiction medicine, and pain management. He directs the Opioid Reassessment Clinic at the VA Connecticut Healthcare System, and he is PI or co-PI of several research projects through the VA, NIH, PCORI, and the FDA. His co-presenter, Brenda Fenton, is a core investigator at the Pain Research Informatics Multimorbidities and Education Center, the PRIME Center, at the West Haven VA. As a member of the Biostatistics and Methods Corps, she conducts independent research and provides statistical support to PRIME investigators. Thank you both for joining us today. Can I turn it over to you?
Yes, thank you, Hera. Hi, folks. I'm Will Becker, and thank you for that introduction. Here with Brenda Fenton, also from the PRIME Center of Innovation. As Hera mentioned, we're going to be talking about dual use of controlled substances in and outside of VA, clinical context, and measurement challenges. I'll be presenting first, and then we'll transition to Brenda about two-thirds through. Before we delve into the content, I'd like to acknowledge our funders and key collaborators who made this work possible. First, VA's Office of Analytics and Business Intelligence and Query Programs, who partnered to fund us. VA HSR&D and our PRIME Center of Innovation at VA Connecticut, Drs. Peter Kreiner and the Prescription Behavior Surveillance System of Brandeis University, Dr. Virginia Therese and VA's Office of Pharmacy Benefits Management, and last but not least, Dave Hopkins, who is program manager for the Kentucky All-Schedule Prescription Electronic Reporting, or CASPER system, the relevance of which will become apparent in the final section of our presentation. We hope that following today's presentation, participants will be better able to describe the current landscape of opioid safety efforts in VA, understand methods for measuring prescription opioid exposure, and understand better the patterns of dual use, both VA and non-VA, of opioids through lessons learned from a project among Kentucky veterans. But before we get started, a quick poll question to hear who is participating today. And the options for the poll are clinician, either primary care, pain, or substance use related, pain researcher, substance use researcher, other researcher, or data scientist slash analyst. And we'll give folks a couple minutes to answer.
Yep, responses are coming in nicely. We're actually just going to give you a few more moments to respond. We've already got 74% of you in, so we don't need to wait too much longer, just waiting for things to slow down, and then we're going to close it out and go through the results.
Okay.
And it looks like we've come to a stop, so I'm going to close that out. And what we're seeing is 38% of the audience saying that they are a clinician, 23% pain researcher, 13% substance use researcher, 33% other researcher, and 16% data scientist or analyst. Thank you, everyone.
Great. So a nice mix of participants. So by way of outline today, we'll first discuss long-term opioid therapy for chronic pain, why VA is pulling back, how VA is pulling back, and evidence that the pullback is working, and yet evidence that opioid overdoses continue to climb. Next, we'll discuss measuring opioid exposure and pharmacoepidemiologic research, and finally, our work examining dual use of opioids and risky prescribing. So on to the first section, but before that, a second quick poll question. Yes, no, do you prescribe opioids?
And again, we'll give everyone a few moments to respond, and we'll go through the results here. And it looks like we've slowed down, so I'm going to close that out. And what we're seeing is 12% of the audience saying that, yes, they do prescribe opioids, and 88% of the audience does not. Thank you, everyone.
All right. So let's start with why the VA is pulling back on long-term opioid therapy, and that starts with this figure, probably familiar to most of you, showing the trends in opioid prescribing and harms. The red line shows that since 1999, opioid sales have quadrupled in the U.S., and we've witnessed alarmingly similar trends in prescription opioid-related deaths, most of which are overdose, shown in green, and treatment admissions for opioid use disorder, shown in blue, across the same time frame. Evidence clearly supports that these trends were causally linked. Moving a little closer to present day, we see these data from SAMHSA from 2008 to 2015 on the x-axis, and opioid-related hospitalizations increasing steadily in the solid line, and emergency department or ED visits increasing steadily in the dashed line. But perhaps the more troubling part then the clear relationship with long-term opioid therapy and harm with CDC and others' review of opioids' effectiveness for chronic pain, finding in 2016 that, quote, no study of opioid therapy versus placebo, no opioid therapy or non-opioid therapy for chronic pain evaluated long-term outcomes related to pain, function, or quality of life. Most placebo-controlled randomized trials were less than 6 weeks in duration, and of those trials, opioids showed marginal benefit, if any. But hot off the presses, we have Aaron Krebs' SPACE trial, which is the very first year-long pragmatic randomized trial of opioids versus non-opioids for chronic back, hip, or knee pain, published 2 weeks ago in JAMA, showing that non-opioid medications were equivalent to opioids for pain-related functional interference, superior to opioids in terms of pain severity, with fewer side effects. Two other aspects of harm that I want to circle back to include the now well-established direct association between prescribed dose and overdose based on several high-quality observational studies, including from Amy Bonnard et al. In 2011. As you can see, as the morphine equivalent daily dose increased in the column on the left, the odds of overdose increased steadily. And in a study from our Veterans Aging Cohort study, we found that co-prescribed benzodiazepines are quite common and increased risk of all-cause mortality. Here we see an increasing hazard ratio for death among long-term opioid recipients in red as the morphine equivalent daily dose increased along the x-axis. When patients received both long-term opioids and benzodiazepines, shown in blue, there appeared to be increased risk of mortality, especially in the 20 to 50 and 50 to 100 milligram opioid dose ranges, which are the most common. Ted Park and Amy Bonnard published a study in BMJ also in 2015 showing benzodiazepine additive relationship in terms of overdose risk as well. And so, in light of the mounting data on risk and equivocal data at best about benefit, the VA released its clinical practice guidelines for opioid therapy for chronic pain several months after CDC's guidelines, with VAs being even more conservative in that the very first recommendation was an emphatic, quote, we recommend against initiation of long-term opioid therapy for pain and instead recommend alternatives to opioids such as self-management strategies and other non-pharmacologic treatments. And then skipping down to number three, for patients already on long-term opioid therapy, recommending ongoing risk mitigation strategies, including some we'll discuss on the next slide, assessment for opioid use disorder, and consideration of tapering when risks exceed benefits. Of note, this last clause was different than CDC's, which said, consider tapering when benefits do not outweigh risks. This sounds subtle, but I actually like CDC's better in principle, since in my view, benefits should have to exceed risk to continue opioid therapy, not just balance each other out. So the VA also instituted the Opioid Safety Initiative in 2014, mandating opioid safety committees at each facility and other opioid safety-related steps, including routine urine drug monitoring, routine querying of the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, or PDMP, that Brenda will discuss in more detail, availability of non-pharmacologic treatment options for pain, and availability of medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder. Which leads us to our final poll question. Have you accessed or used an opioid safety dashboard? Often, sometimes, rarely, or never.
And again, we'll give everyone a few moments to respond before we close it out and go through the results. And looks like we're slowing down here, so I'm going to close this out. And what we're seeing is 22% of the audience saying that they often use an opioid safety dashboard, 12% saying sometimes, 14% rarely, and 52% never. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. So given all these efforts, we see in data published by Waleed Jalad and Secretary Shulkin last year, VA has seen declines in both overall prescribing, shown in the dotted blue line, and in metrics of risky prescribing, including percent with concurrent opioid and benzodiazepine prescriptions, shown in black, and percent with greater than 100 milligram morphine equivalent daily dose, shown in orange. And yet, despite these marked improvements in prescribing metrics, it appears that opioid overdose continues to rise. So I want to acknowledge two caveats. The data on the previous slide were VA-specific, and here I'm showing you non-VA-specific data. Further, only 15 states reported data so far. But with those caveats in mind, of the 15 states reporting from July 6, 2016 through September 2017, four found a 50% or greater increase in opioid overdose. Three found a 25 to 49% increase. Three found a 1 to 24% increase. And five of the 15 states decreased, but we don't know by how much. And so the answer to why prescribing has dropped but overdoses continue to rise in most reporting states requires a multifactorial explanation. First, there has undoubtedly been transition to other opioids. For veterans, this could mean non-VA prescribed pills, especially now that the CHOICE program could potentially provide increased access to outside prescribers. But this could also mean transition to non-prescribed pills or cheaper, more potent heroin, or high-potency fentanyl and its analogs, the latter of which leads to a higher per-use rate of overdose, especially among individuals not expecting fentanyl to be there. And by that, I mean some heroin supplies are being surreptitiously cut with fentanyl, leading to a higher rate of death among individuals who overdose. There could be substitution of other agents that contribute to overdose, for example, alcohol and benzodiazepine, so I will quickly note there's not much evidence for this. Another factor would be so-called lag time of the epidemic. Today's victims are experiencing consequences of prescribing patterns from 10 years ago as they have progressed from increasing doses to possible opioid use disorder to possible transition to illicit opioids to overdose. Then on the treatment side, access to medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder may not be keeping up with demand, and access to naloxone may not be keeping up with demand as well. And naloxone, to note, is the opioid antagonist that reverses overdoses. Of those states where we have seen decreases in overdose rates, specifically Massachusetts, they've achieved this through greater expansion of medication-assisted treatment and access to naloxone without a prescription. So to help us delve more deeply into these potential explanations, we're now going to discuss measuring opioid exposure in pharmacoepidemiologic research. First, a few words about terminology. Opioids is the proper term for the whole medication class together, which includes opiates and opioids. Opiates are naturally occurring compounds present in opium from the seed of the papaver somniferum plant, examples of which are morphine and codeine. With the addition of two acetyl groups, you have heroin. Opioids are manufactured and can be divided into semisynthetics such as oxycodone, hydrocodone, and hydromorphone, and full synthetics such as fentanyl, methadone, and buprenorphine. Then we have medication-assisted therapy for the treatment of opioid use disorder, which is the DSM-5's term for opioid addiction. And these medications include methadone in liquid form dispensed by federally regulated opiate treatment programs. Importantly, when dispensed through an OTP, methadone is not listed in PBM/Vinci files. They're in separate files. Then buprenorphine, the sublingual tablet or film, which is listed in PBM/Vinci files. And finally, the opioid antagonist naltrexone, when used to treat OUD, is typically by intramuscular injection, and it is also listed in PBM/Vinci. I want to mention three common sources of confusion, and those are that there is, one, a buprenorphine patch, trade name of Butran, which is exclusively used for pain. Second, sublingual buprenorphine use off-label for pain is very rare in VA, so you can assume sublingual buprenorphine is for opioid use disorder. Finally, methadone for OUD and methadone for pain can be reliably distinguished by their formulation. OUD is liquid and pain is pills, but most reliably by who is holding the data. And that is Vinci has pain data and the OTPs have opioid use disorder data. On a side note, I avoid the term narcotic because it's a non-medical term, but also for its whiff of criminality. I'm sure some folks remember Crockett and Tubbs from Miami Vice. They use the term narcotic. And as hard as it is to resist, please don't be like Crockett and Tubbs in this regard, but certainly feel free to adopt their fashion sense. So I created this grid to help us talk through sources of opioid exposure. Down the far left-hand column, we have indication for use, and that would include pain, treatment of opioid use disorder, or illicit use. Then moving across the top row, we have setting, which is either within VHA or outside VHA, and within both of those categories, we have outpatient and inpatient exposure. And then all the way to the right, we have non-healthcare associated exposure, which is reserved for illicit use. So simply put, the sources you want to measure depends on your research question. And let's go through a few quick examples to illustrate this. So for our research question that Brenda is going to speak more about, does having access to outside prescribers lead to riskier outpatient opioid regimens for pain? We examine not only within VA outpatient prescriptions, but also outside VA opioid prescriptions. If your question was, for example, does cumulative opioid exposure among oft-hospitalized older patients lead to premature death, you would probably want to consider measuring all four of the top row. And if you were asking the whole enchilada question, what additional opioid exposure is contributing to rising overdose rates, you would probably want to look at the whole enchilada. I would note that those treatments for opioid use disorder should be considered protective factors in any model, as adequate treatment of opioid use disorder should be protective of overdose risk. But let's get back to our research question. Does having access to outside prescribers lead to riskier outpatient opioid regimens for pain? Step one is calculating morphine equivalent dose. This is the method of standardizing potency across various opioid compounds based on equal analgesic tables from dose ranging studies. Here you see the standard conversion table on the right from the CDC telling us, for example, 20 milligrams of oxycodone is equivalent to 30 milligrams of morphine. Therefore, a patient on 20 milligrams of oxycodone three times a day would have a 90 milligram morphine equivalent daily dose. Then you want to assign a per day dose to each individual in the sample. Each individual prescription has a start date, a medication and strength, number of pills and directions, and days supplied from which you can calculate an end date. So for example, morphine sustained release 30 milligram tab, take one tab three times a day for 28 days, 84 pills prescribed. So for that 28 day period, milligram morphine equivalent daily dose is equal to 90. However, over the same 28 day period, this case patient received oxycodone immediate release 10 milligram tab, take one tab four times a day as needed. 112 pills prescribed. And for the sake of this research, we assume that the patient takes at the maximum interval prescribed. So that would be an additional 40 milligrams a day of oxycodone or an additional 60 milligram morphine equivalent daily dose. So this patient's overall total morphine equivalent daily dose is 150. And of course, with all the math, the denominator is important. Here's an example. So over 4 months, we're talking about a patient who received three 30-day prescriptions for morphine immediate release 15 milligrams three times a day, or 90 pills. These prescriptions were interrupted by two 15-day hospitalizations. So for that 120-day period, the total milligram morphine received was 45 times 90, or 4,050 milligrams. So the average exposure over the time period is 450 divided by 120, or 33¾ milligram per day. However, the average daily dose was 450 divided by 90, or 45 milligrams morphine equivalent daily dose. So the convention is to only calculate dose for the days in which the medication was actually prescribed. There still may be good reasons to calculate average exposure over a period of time. Point is, you need to be clear about your decisions and the rationale and to communicate them clearly in your methods. So, for outpatient pain prescribing, we typically include oral or transdermal preparations, including the specific opioid types listed here, such as codeine, hydrocodone, and oxycodone. On the right-hand side is what we typically exclude. And then, as we already discussed, we use standard conversion factors to determine morphine equivalent dose of each prescription. And so with that, I will turn things over to Brenda.
Okay, thank you, Will. So I'm going to be talking about the work we've done to look at dual use of opioids or in risky prescribing. So, as Will mentioned earlier, the prescription drug monitoring program plays a very important part of understanding the whole picture of opioids. In this outpatient setting, we can look at VA and non-VA outpatient prescriptions, every prescription for a 72-hour or more supply of a controlled substance must be put into the PDMP, or sometimes called PMP. Prescription monitoring program. And these prescriptions are associated with the individual medical provider's DEA number. Each state has one, and there are agreements that allow providers to look across multiple states. For example, in our facility, VA Connecticut providers can see scripts for controlled substances written in Connecticut as well as 29 other states. VA facilities began sharing prescription data with the state PBMP very recently. The VA Directive 1306 was dated October 19th, 2016. The PBMP allows clinicians to look at the controlled substances being prescribed to a patient both inside and outside the VA in near real time. Prescriptions need to be added to the PBMP within 24 hours, which means there is a slight lag if someone was to go to, say, two prescribers in one day. But overall, we feel that this is quick, and some people are uploading their prescription data within 1 to 2 hours. And the system can detect which individual patients each PBMP registrant is querying. So we can actually see what proportion of patients are getting the safety check prior and tie that to individual providers. So that's very important when we think about the aggregate data. So this is the individual clinicians, individual patients, but the PBMP also serves to give us a big picture of what's going on across geographic areas, so states or regions within a given state, across time, which we can sync to policy changes or just look at the natural, secular trends, and across health providers. We can see, as I mentioned before, the use of queries, and then ultimately the prescriptions that are dispensed by providers. So our project's objective was to determine whether out-of-system access to controlled substance providers was associated with risky opioid therapy among veterans after adjusting for key demographic and clinical characteristics. And as you can say, this is about risky opioids, not opioids overall, and these were defined by the 2016 CPC guidelines, which are also are part of the VA guidelines, so we're targeting dosages above, at or above 90 milligram morphine, milligram morphine equivalents per day, and concurrent opioid and benzodiazepine prescription. Okay, so this is describing our sample. It was a prospective cohort study. We were able to access CASPER records and CHOICE program enrollment, and so we looked at Connecticut residing veterans who enrolled in the CHOICE program, and then we created a matched control group. And we used a 1-to-4 ratio for that, and we matched on sex, age, plus or minus 5 years, and race, ethnicity. And the CHOICE sample was 8,984, and the comparison group, 35,651. So there is the CASPER system, which Will mentioned earlier. We looked at data over an 18-month period. This was January 2015 through June 2016, so it is right before that last citation that Will mentioned, which was looking at data starting in July 2016 through 2017. And we looked at demographic factors. I mentioned we matched on those, and clinical factors. And the clinical factors were mental health and addiction diagnoses. We also looked at cancer in an attempt to control for any palliative or end-of-life pain management. The clinical diagnoses were ICD-9 or 10, with one inpatient or two outpatient visits with that diagnosis over an 18-month period. All of the diagnoses were higher in the CHOICE group, despite this matching on demographics. And the outcomes, as I mentioned before, risky prescribing, which is high-dose opioids being at or greater than 90, and or the combination. And we used a very generous definition of at least one day of overlap. So as Will has already mentioned, when we're looking at these prescriptions, we're using a medicine cabinet supply approach. We're taking each prescription available and calculating the number of days each will last. If there's more than one, we're stacking them or adding their morphine equivalents together. And for benzodiazepines, they're considered to be delivered in combination if there's one day of overlap of the prescription, regardless of the dose. Okay, so first table is showing us opioids with in the choice group in yellow and the non-choice. And we can see that when it comes to any opioid, not risky opioids, but any opioids, choice participants had higher rates of these dispenses, I guess we'll call them. We use dispenses. We can't tell if the person is actually taking them, but that is our proxy to use dispenses. So we can see 50% in the choice group, about 37% in the non-choice. The overall opioid proportion was 38%. And so we see high dose, and we see the high risk prescribing at much lower rates, thankfully, but again, the choice group is higher. Okay, looking at high dose opioids in a logistic regression, which included the whole sample, so 44,000-ish. And I've highlighted in yellow some of the take-home messages. Number one, that choice status, being enrolled in choice, you were more likely to receive a high dose opioid, and that was statistically significant. Just wanted to point out that the cancer diagnosis was also associated with high dose opioids, as we expected. Due to its involvement in palliative or end-of-life care. And opioid use disorder was highly related to the prescription of high-dose opioids, five times likely to have high-dose opioids if you had an opioid use disorder. When we're looking at the combination of opioid and benzodiazepines, we still see that choice status makes a difference. You are more likely to get a combination of opioids and benzodiazepines if you're enrolled in the CHOICE program, which, remember, we're taking that as a proxy for higher access to non-VA providers. Again, the cancer diagnosis and opioid use disorder also being associated with benzodiazepine combinations. And as I mentioned, in terms of the clinical conditions, at the bottom we are seeing there are several significant variables going in different directions. For example, PTSD being folks with PTSD being more likely to get opioid benzo combination, and for example, those with alcohol use disorder less likely to get that script. Now we're going to switch from looking at the entire sample, the 44,000 some odd, to just focusing in on those who received an opioid, any opioid. And that brings us down to the 17,600. And what we're looking for in this group is who prescribed those, at least one of those opioids. If a non-VA provider was involved in the prescription of opioids for this patient. And what you can see is that choice, the significance of the choice status basically disappears. And now what's coming to the forefront is having at least one non-VA prescriber of opioids. So odds ratio of 2.16, highly significant. And this is really our main take-home message, that when you delve into the opioid prescription and can distinguish the non-VA from VA providers, there's additional risk associated with being seen or getting a prescription from a non-VA physician. Now, how did we determine who was a non-VA provider? This was done with the use of zip codes. And the reason why we did this was that we could categorize the VA medical centers, CBOCs, and the direct mail facility zip codes. And then those that were not in those zip codes were considered, those prescribers were non-VA prescribers. And this is important because someone who works in the VA could also work outside the VA. And so using DEA numbers can be problematic because someone has the same DEA number whether they're prescribing within VA or outside of VA. So the zip code was able to differentiate. We know that some people will be missed or misclassified, but there is no reason to believe that that is differential. So we see that the odds of being prescribed a high-dose opioid is increased over 2 times when a patient has at least one non-VA provider. This might suggest that outside VA prescribers may have been unaware of a person's clinical history. We see that opioid use disorder is also highly significantly related to this. So a person could be, a non-VA provider could be unaware of an opioid use disorder, a past clinical disorder in one of their patients, and going on to then give a high dose opioid. This is the opioid benzodiazepine combination. And again, we see that choice status, which is the proxy for getting outside access to providers, is non-significant, and non-VA prescriber is significant. So roughly 2.5 times as likely to get the combo prescription if you see at least one non-VA prescriber. So again, the opioid disorder being higher as well, and again, the cancer being higher. And as I said, cancer is largely there to try to adjust for some of the palliative or end-of-life use of opioids for pain management. So what are the limitations of this work? Well, we had a list of choice enrollees, and we did not have confirmation that they used services under choice. We were able to find prescriptions for them from VA providers as well as non-VA providers, but we are not sure that they actually used their card, a choice card, to access a non-VA provider. We failed to exclude persons with terminal illness or those in palliative care, but we did include cancer as a covariate. Also, it was a little bit unlikely that someone would be trying to access choice for specifically aiding in their palliative care. So as far as we're concerned, these limitations are not fatal flaws, and the consistency of our results make us feel confident that this is an important finding, that non-VA prescribers independently increase the likelihood of risky opioid prescriptions in Kentucky veterans prescribed opioids. And of course, there is always the issue of generalizability, and we would really encourage people to use PDMP data and try to get a sense of what this inside and outside of care access is doing to, with respect to risk, because VA has so many things in place to address risky opioids, and people being able to access outside may in fact increase their risk of being prescribed more opioids or in combination with benzodiazepines. So the recommendation that we would have would be the standard of care is the review of the PDMT database prior to prescribing. And as we said, that can be looked at the provider level to see, you know, are people checking, are people making queries for all the prescriptions prior to the prescriptions that they're writing. The ongoing challenge is the sharing of diagnostic history. And as you saw in the model, having an opioid use disorder was more associated with high dose and combination opioids. And although if that, and sorry, just to clarify, those opioid use disorders diagnoses were made in the VA. So within VA, a provider could see, oh, this person has had issues with opioids in the past, excuse me, but the non-VA providers are not able to access that information, which puts them at a bit of a deficit in terms of their decision-making for dispensing of opioids. Okay, so I think that is it from our individual data, and I will hand it back to Will to...
No problem. Thanks, Brenda. So really just wanted to summarize our remarks today. So because of concerns over lack of efficacy and significant harms, VA has successfully reduced system-wide opioid therapy in conjunction with increased safety monitoring, increased non-opioid pain treatments, and increased access to treatment for opioid use disorder, although there's certainly work to be done on all those fronts. Yet overdose rates continue to rise. This may in part be due to outside VA opioid access, either licit or illicit. The sources of non-VA opioid access study depends on the research question, and PDMP data combined with standard approaches to quantifying opioid exposure using prescription data is a compelling approach for measuring outside VA controlled substance receipt. And with that, Brenda and I would like to thank you for your attention and would be happy to open it up for questions.
All right. Thank you, Will and Brenda. We do have a few questions here from the audience. If you guys have any additional questions, please keep sending those in, and I'll get started with what we have. All right. The first question. I thought government did not allow researchers to access PDMP data. How did you get access for research?
So we were funded by the Office of Analytics and Business Intelligence as a quality improvement project, since the question really was, what's the safety risk that our veterans are under with the potential expanded access of the CHOICE program to outside controlled substance prescribers? So it was really a question of quality and safety that sparked this research. And Kentucky was very excited to partner with us to help answer this question from a quality standpoint. But it's very true that Kentucky was fairly unique in its willingness to do that, and not all states would do that.
All right, thank you. Next question. Were there any non-choice vets who still received care outside the VA?
Yeah.
They could. That wasn't our sampling frame, but there are what?
They could always pay their own prescription. They're always free to go outside if they're not happy with the options. Our point in looking at choice was that it was really opening up that access, and they would be reimbursed for their out-of-pocket aid to pharmacies, et cetera. So they might be more inclined to get services outside since it wasn't coming out of, since they didn't have to pay for those expenses. But we do see a fair amount of non-VA provider use. And that's why I think that once you look at that, the CHOICE program kind of fell away. And it's that non-VA provider access overall that associated increased risk of these opioid prescribing practices.
All right, thank you. Next question. Can patients access opioid use disorder programs through choice? And are there any opioid use disorder programs available through the VA?
So there's definitely, each VA facility offers evidence-based treatment for opioid use disorder. That's a organization-wide mandate. That said, the access to these therapies tends to be concentrated at the Tier 1 facilities. And it is sometimes difficult for CBOC patients to access evidence-based OUD treatment within VA. So, for example, here in Connecticut, our methadone clinic is located here in West Haven. And so if you're a veteran from, you know, the far northeast corner of the state with OUD, to get VA methadone, you have to travel to West Haven. And so I know VA is actively trying to resolve some of these access issues. Karen Drexler and others are hard at work at this. I don't know whether so I guess the question would then become, if you're more than 40 miles from a methadone clinic, could you get it choiced out? And I would want to think the answer to that question is yes, but I don't know 100% sure on that.
All right, thank you. All right, we still have several questions here. What about using pharmacy type, VA versus non-VA, to differentiate VA providers? Presumably, all opioids prescribed by VA providers will be filled out at a VA pharmacy and vice versa.
Yeah, that's essentially the approach we were trying to take with the zip code. You know, the PDMP data is somewhat limited depending on the state you're in. We were getting the most reliable indicator we had was the zip code. And as Brenda alluded to, that pretty fairly reliably differentiated between VA and non-VA pharmacies. Of course, you can imagine that there are some zip codes where there is both a VA and a non-VA pharmacy. Then we tried to drill down to what is the payment source of most of the prescriptions coming out of that zip code. And if it was predominantly VA, then we assumed that to be a VA pharmacy.
But it was at one point in choice, people were coming with their prescription from an outside, a non-VA provider, and then the VA provider was rewriting that prescription and filling it in the VA. So that made the prescription side difficult, which was why we also had the prescriber zip code in order to identify the providers.
Yeah, and that's very true. Early on, there was a lot of variation in how these prescriptions were being handled, and we tried to sort it out to the highest degree of validity possible. I imagine, you know, in 2018, those processes might be more standardized across the board, and we'll be in touch with our partner, Ginny Therese, to find out if that's indeed the case.
All right, thank you. Still have a few more questions. Did you account for possible confounding between the opioid use disorder prescribers and the non-VA providers?
Opioid provider prescribers, those would not have been, the opioid use treatment providers would not have been in the PDMP.
Yeah, I'm trying to... I think that question might be getting at, were some of our prescribers actually, addiction specialists who were treating opioid use disorder.
And we did remove those particular drugs.
Yeah.
As Will had mentioned, methadone, bupe,
right.
That was in this slide. So we
right. We did remove medications that likely would have been prescribed by an OUD specialist. So we believe we addressed that, if that was the question.
All right. Thank you. Are you measuring ADE rates to opioids through either administrative claims in your health systems and or system-wide standardized reporting?
So that's the next step with this work. You know, we showed differential rates of risky prescribing with folks who get outside access, and then our next step would be, are the differential rates of ADEs among people who have access to non-VA prescribers? We haven't taken that step. With this work, we're certainly involved in that work with other projects. So if anybody has specific questions about codes, you should feel free to email us.
All right. Thank you. For those patients with OUD, was it buprenorphine prescription from outside VA providers captured?
So we didn't. That OUD diagnosis, those were coming from when we matched our choice to non-choice folks, we used OUD diagnoses that were in the VA record. It wasn't that the medications were being prescribed for the treatment of OUD. It's that these people had a history of OUD, and they were being prescribed opioids for pain. So we excluded buprenorphine and liquid methadone for the treatment of OUD. And that brings up Brenda's point, which is that, you know, how is it that somebody is getting dual prescriptions of opioids and they have for pain when they have a history of OUD, and it's possible and probably likely that the outside prescriber wasn't aware of the diagnosis that was coded within VA because PDMP does not include diagnostic information.
All right, moving right along. Sorry, oh, go ahead.
We used in the multivariate modeling all came from the VA record.
Yeah.
All right, thank you. We're moving on to the last question. Is there a systematic referral process for OUD to MAT?
There's high variability in that regard. Some facilities have a nice sort of step care model, and some facilities need to make improvements in that regard. And I mentioned Karen Drexler before. This is one of her efforts that she's really championing to try to standardize the step care model for access to evidence-based OUD treatment and make sure that it's in place across the VA. Now, a major undertaking, to say the least, but this is definitely a major focus of VA's quality improvement work.
All right. Will and Brenda, thank you so much for taking the time to present today's session. Those are all the questions we had from the audience. Do you guys have any last comments to make before we wrap things up?
No, just want to say thanks for folks' attention and all the great questions.
All right. And if you have additional questions, the audience, you guys can contact the presenters directly. Their contact information is on the screen right now. Please tune in for the next session in BIREX Partnered Research Cyber Seminar Series next month on Tuesday, April 17th at 12 p.m. Eastern. Dr. Bridget Smith will present on MyHealthyVet data in a presentation titled Examining the Association of MyHealthyVet, Healthcare Utilization, and Costs. We hope you can make it. Thank you once again for attending. Heidi, can I turn